Welcome back, my Get Fit friends. I am bummed out. Summer is over, but I'm super happy to have a new episode ready for you. And this one I'm calling What is Up with Our Kids? Featuring a conversation with Brett Klicka, CEO of SpiderFit Kids and a past IDEA Personal Trainer of the Year. Now, if you have kids, and especially if they're in sports or thinking of joining sports, then this one is for you. I've enjoyed speaking with Brett over the years, watching him speak at various conferences, and I've often picked his brain on our approach to kids' fitness and health. So I'm glad I was able to track him down because he has a ton of great advice. So sit back and enjoy a conversation with one of the fitness industry greats, Brett Klicka. Now, a couple of quick disclaimers. This information is not intended to replace your healthcare professional. Opinions of hosts and guests do not represent the views or opinions of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, KFHP, Kaiser Foundation Hospitals, KFH, or Southern California Permanente Medical Group, SCPMG. Neither KFHP, KFH, or SCPMG receive any compensation for products or services mentioned on the show, nor do they endorse or promote any products mentioned. With that, enjoy the show. All right, BK, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew.
Am I the only one that calls you BK?
No. Okay. That's become widespread at this point.
I thought that was a cool, unique thing. Yeah. So this is Brett Klicka. Thanks so much for being here. I do want to start by just telling you a couple things. I don't know if you remember this, but when I first started at Kaiser Permanente, we used to have this big conference called the Brand Conference. And you guys came up and you guys like ran the boot camps in the morning.
Well, Todd Durkin and
yeah.
I.
Yep. And I remember like waking up early. We like met you in the lobby. You had like all the stretch cords around your neck.
Yeah.
And we like ran out into some civic center and worked out. And I remember at the time, like after meeting you and Todd, and I had this really cool job thinking like, I could see myself doing that someday. So I want to thank you. You kind of pushed me in that direction.
Oh, cool.
Just
thank
watching you.
You
guys have so much fun. And you were just a baby at the time, man. You were.
That would have been 15, 16,
see.
17 years ago.
Yeah. At least I want to say maybe 08, 09, somewhere around there.
I think it was
further
before
back.
That, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you guys did it a couple times.
We did. We did.
So cool.
Yeah.
The second thing I want to thank you for is through the course of, you know, coming to some of your presentations and listening to you speak, you taught me to share. And there was a time where like I would give a presentation, someone said, hey, can I have your deck? And I'm like, no way, man. I worked hard on that. And the funny thing about you teaching me to share is I was using your 5-4-3-2-1 plan in my deck. And I'm like, all right, I'm the biggest hypocrite. So thank you for that.
Well,
I really appreciate that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So cool. Well, you know, we are here in the month of September, and it is National Childhood Obesity Month. And I know you've talked in the past a little bit about growing up and you being kind of an overweight kid. So why don't we start there? And then you can kind of tell us, you know, what was your journey out here to Southern California and how did you become a trainer?
Yeah. So I was, as a kid, I was a overweight kid, and it was more of a, I did come from a culture of wellness. I came from a family that was into being active and eating right. And so I think that it was an effect of, partly because I tend to have an extreme personality. So if I was going to eat, I was going to eat a lot. Mm. And it wasn't so much that I was eating the bad things. I was eating too much. I was an active kid, but I mean, quite frankly, it was kind of like those kid things. Like I lived in Oregon, had allergies. So I kind of would have allergy induced asthma and I couldn't do certain things. And then I had Osgood Schlatter's really bad in my knees.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So really I liked being active, but I just wasn't as active as I could be. And there were some frustrations there because I had, and there's some obesity in the family. And so I was an overweight kid and everything tied to that. But like I said, coming from a culture of wellness and having access to parents that were active and everything, my mom would get up every morning, go to the track and walk. And she would invite me to come and say, hey, you know, come with me. And eventually, I did. I started to do it, and it probably would have been about sixth, seventh grade. I'd had enough of just being kind of the overweight, slow kid. Cause I did play sports and it kind of sucks, you know, being wanting to, but not being able to do it. So I started walking and then I started running and then I took, I took it by the horns and was like, no, this is my thing now. And I still saved the pair of shoes. They're in my attic, actually, that I went from being kind of an overweight kid to losing weight. And just, and it wasn't so much the weight, it was taking control of my life. And I learned that at a young age, and that had a powerful, powerful impact on me, because it was probably, and I share this story, and I've just started to share this story because it's part of my journey. I remember I was like in fifth or sixth grade. So this is right as I'm on the upswing and starting to take control of my own life, with my parents' support. I remember having a dream. Literally, I remember this from being that age. I had this dream where I'm like teaching fitness classes, and I'm helping all these people, and these people are like following me around, and I'm helping them kind of do what I was going through. And it was one of those things that, like, when you're that age, you don't have these like delusions of grandeur. You're not thinking, well, that's what I'm going to do someday. I had a visceral reaction to it, to the point where I remember it later in life. And honestly, I can say that I knew what I wanted to do from about fifth grade on.
Had you seen somebody do that, or how?
Yeah. So a part of that was the 80s. This would have been in the 80s. And that was a unique time in sort of gym culture. The gym industry was emerging. The box gym industry was really emerging. And my uncle, Joe, was a competitive bodybuilder and a champion bodybuilder. He was Mr. Oregon. He was a professional bodybuilder.
Holy
and
cow.
It just was really interesting to me, even as a young kid, to just see this very unique thing, this culture. I would go to the gym with him at like 8 or 9 years old. He'd work out and I'd just be there and just hang out. And even at that age, I thought it was interesting to me. And so I had these great influences and all these things going on around me. So, and that's why even today in the message that I share, it's the culture. If we want children, it's not so much boot camping our children into getting in shape. It's,
right.
It's sort of surrounding them with a supportive, I call it a culture of wellness. And eventually some of these things set in, and it's not a matter of dieting. It's not a matter of like hardcore exercise for these short bouts of time. It's a matter of just saying, what do I want to do? What do I enjoy doing? What feels good? And what leads me to where I want to go? So, you know, that was early on. And then I realized right then, it's like, well, hey, what can I do from here on out that's active? Even with things like work, I was, when I turned like 12 or 13, I came from a family, and I'm very thankful for this today, but it was like, you ain't coasting. Like,
right.
You work in
right.
the summertime. And I think a lot of us, that's the reality of when we are young is you do earn some money. You work. You're not just going to sit around home or pretend like you're going to be a professional athlete and just play tournaments every day. You got to work. And I was picking weeds for older women at our church.
Yeah.
I hated that more than you could hate anything. And it developed this idea. I was like, I can't imagine working every day. It's something that I hate. I couldn't fathom it. Like, because I didn't want to wake up in the morning. I mean, here I'm like 13 years old. I'm like depressed.
Right.
Like, I don't, how can you do this? I'm looking at my dad go to work every day. I'm looking at my mom going to work every day. I'm like, how do you control the depression? How do you control the idea? And so I did that for a little while, and I'd kind of, you know, figure out different ways during the summer because of the expectation in my house that you worked in. And eventually I came across coaching soccer. And I could work for, I think it was Skyhawks soccer organizations. We put on these soccer camps for kids. And all of a sudden, I'm making more money than I did picking weeds for
now, how old are you at this point?
I would have been about 14 or 15.
Oh, wow.
And I was 15.
Okay.
Because I remember they hired me actually young because they knew that I'd get my license. Because you had to have a driver's
right.
license.
Okay.
And so I'd start doing that. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I came home from work the first day, and I was like, you can love what you do?
Yeah.
That was an amazing day. I can't wait till tomorrow. That's me. That's what I'm going to do. I don't care how much money there is to be made. I want to look forward to getting up every single day. And that's really where I started. And so I got good grades and everything in high school, and I played all the sports. And that really was a centerpiece of my life. And here I'm anchored by this notion that this physical activity gave me autonomy over my life, and it allowed me to, you know, I believe that I just was always going to be this overweight kid. That was going to be me. That was my identity. And exercise taught me that, hey, you can take autonomy. And that spread into other things, you know, control in the emotional dimension and the mental dimension. Just, we do have autonomy over our lives. And I thought, man, this is something I want to share. And that went into my selection of what I wanted to do in college. Went to Oregon State University. I knew right away, exercise science. That is where I'm going. I chose the university based on their exercise science lab. Just, that's really what I was looking for. And, you know, through that experience, continue to be very active, learning more and more about the human body. And honestly, spending my college time volunteering in every aspect of fitness. I was in the bone lab. I was in the women's fitness lab. I was in the motor skills clinic, which is for special needs populations. I was playing sports. I was volunteering in the strength and conditioning department working with, because I couldn't get enough. Even as a college kid, and I had my fun too. I was a college kid, believe me.
Right.
But I had this obsession for, wow, this is how different people from these different aspects of life are having autonomy over their own life. And when you learn more about how exercise and really physical activity impacts the brain and emotions and behavior, you realize, well, no, there's something behind that. To think that exercise is just exercise and exercise just is something that makes us healthy in the physical dimension. It does, but realize that the mental thing, the self-efficacy that happens emotionally and even mentally, what it does to our brain and our ability to focus and our ability to actually use our prefrontal cortex, all these cool things happen. And the more I learned about that, I was like, man, this is it. This is what I want to do. And here I have my guidance counselors telling me, well, you know, and this is like 1995, 96. And my guidance counselor's like, well, this is it's a labor of love, yeah. But you're looking at $25,000 a year is what the average income is for, right. You know, you're not going to be paying back any college loans anytime soon. And I just did, to me, that was like, and even my parents, I remember my dad in particular was like, really? What are we looking at when you get out of college? I was like, don't worry. I'm making this work. Like, this is what I'm going to do. And through all the things I did in college, I compiled a resume that allowed me to, become an intern. I got an internship at the U.S. Olympic Training Center down here in San Diego, and that brought me from Oregon to San Diego, and then that's what brought me to Southern California, and that's what that really was a significant step in really setting up a career. It was a powerful resume builder, a powerful networking tool, and I was able to leverage that into all kinds of different opportunities.
Oh, that's cool. And you know, I think it's a great message to parents, because if you think about your childhood, you could have gone another direction.
Oh, completely.
You know what I mean? And you could have mentally and physically gone down a path that would have been a lot harder to recover from.
Yeah.
And I think at a young age, you know, you had those situations, whether it was the coaching or the dream,
yeah,
where you really turned it around. So I think that's important for parents to really know, like, hey, it is never too late to kind of change the tide, so to speak.
Yeah. And a large part of that was just, it wasn't like, hey, Brett, you're overweight, you need to go on a diet. Hey, Brett, you need to go out and run some laps, because that's what overweight people need to do. It was more like, this is what we do in our family. You know, exercises, you see us being active. We go on bike rides because it's fun. Mom gets up to walk or run in the morning because it makes her feel better. It wasn't, hey, mom's on a diet, mom has to go to this exercise program, so I'm trying to lose 15 pounds. It was very much like, hey, we welcome you to join, because this is cool. This is fun. And I think you talk about the path. I think the most important path that it led me on, quite frankly, wasn't even physical. I think it was mental. It was realizing that, not to sound cliche, but you can do what you want to do if you make a decision.
Yeah.
And it's just coming. And obviously those are guided by, you know, what's your why and how powerful is that? But it made me realize, well, there are things I can change my life, and it doesn't have to be a provincial, like, this is where you're set. And that transferred into things that I did from an academic standpoint, from a business standpoint. So I really feel that the path was obviously physical, but it was very powerful mentally as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. And we're getting off on a little sidebar. Okay, we're going to follow up with getting to San Diego,
yeah.
But, I think for young people, the what's your why is the big thing.
Like, yeah,
they haven't quite figured it out. And I want to say it's not that they're not trying hard enough,
yeah,
but they, like, because they don't know, they sometimes accept the mm-hmm. things that are given to them or the environment that they're in. And I think once that kind of light bulb does go off the way it went off for you,
yeah,
then you kind of can put a you know, a plan in motion.
Yeah.
Well, cool. So, okay. So you end up in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing when you first get here?
Yeah. So it was funny. It was 1999, December 28th, 2 days till the end of the world. And I remember it was so funny, because I'm nervous. This is a new experience. I'm coming down. I'm living at the Olympic Training Center. So I'm a combination of super unbelievably excited, because this is like a unbelievable experience not many people get, but then terrified because this is a experience not a lot of people get. I mean, I'm hoping that, I don't know what I'm heading into, this whole thing. And I get down there and then add on top of that, this whole pandemonium behind Y2K and how just, so I'm leaving my family 2 days before supposedly it all, you know, hits the fan. And obviously that didn't happen, but I get down there and, you know, right away I settle in and I realize, okay, you know, I figure out, you know, I navigate, well, this is gonna be my life for at least the next 6 months and living with these. And one thing that opened my eyes to working with that level of athlete, and this transcends sports and this transcends physical activity, but, just the high performer mindset. And that's really stuck with me. And it was an example to follow, but it was also a universal truth about high performers. And, you know, a lot of the commonalities amongst the Olympic athletes who, their why, they have a bunch of different whys. And you hope that, you know, as you work with them, you want to find out a why that is beyond the sport. You know, that why are they running? Well, because I'm trying to win. Well, you hope that there's more than that because then they're able to sustain a career. But just to be around that level of high performance and just everything they do is based on how can I do this the best. And I've met people and I admire people and I've really tried to emulate that from the business world, from and anything. I mean, there's people that are amazing parents. Their why is to be the best parent or their why is to be the best. So that was early, that was one of the big things that I picked up. And so I'm going every day and I'm helping do strength and conditioning programs, the different sports. And I'm pretty much living, you know, down in Chula Vista, it's compound. You live on the compound. So pretty much for the first couple months, I didn't really leave the compound. I didn't have a car. I just immersed myself in that world of performance and day to day. And so I did that and I was there through the internship was about 6 months. It was a little bit longer just because of the timing. And then the canoe and kayak team asked me right before the Sydney Olympics if I would come on and be kind of a strength and conditioning coach slash team administrator slash pretty much do everything for the team aside from help them canoe and kayak better. So I did that. And then afterwards, it's a pretty cush life living there. You don't make much money, but you have no worries that someone cleans your room. They'll give you a car if you need a car. They have Chevy sponsorships. It was this cush life, but I wasn't really moving forward. I had, you know, my now wife, my then girlfriend, she had finished up her degree in Oregon. She was going to be moving down. So I was kind of in this little jump off point. I was like, well, I need to find something outside of here. I got to leave this cush world and I need to make some money. I need to get a real job. And that kind of terrified me because I didn't know what that would look like. Like I had this plan of like, and have my own business and do strength and conditioning, particularly with kids. You know, it was funny. I cycled through to the best athletes in the world, but still in my heart was I really enjoyed working with young kids because I saw that as an opportunity to build. And it's funny, I'm not an engineer. I'm horrible at math, but the notion of building things and building machines that work. And I see the human body as that. And I really like cars. Cars are this machine you can build. And so seeing things that way, I reached this freak out point. And one day the final straw was there's really nobody around there. It's after the Olympics. I'm living there, just kind of going to the cafeteria, doing some stuff with the team. I'm going to grad school at the time. And a tumbleweed blew through the center of the facility. And I remember that just like, okay, it's time. And I just kind of reached out and through some acquaintances, Todd Durkin, who's now become a huge influencer in the fitness space globally, he was just opening his little, I think it was 1200 square foot carpet floored Smith machine having.
It was like an old 7-Eleven, right?
Or well, something like that. That's the new facility. That's the facility. New one. The okay. old one was the old video store.
Holy cow.
This is where LaDainian Todd, this is where some of the Drew Brees, this is where some of the best athletes and the best NFL players and MLB and now we got UFC. I mean, you name a sport and some of the best athletes in that sport trained through there. This was an old video store. And I remember him, we met, it was kind of a funny story how we met and all these different things go down and he's like, well, let me show you the place. He sold it as like this athlete performance facility. If you know Todd, you know, he can sell anything.
And you were coming from Olympic facility.
I was coming from the Olympic facility.
Right,
I go in, this was a hotel gym. It had a carpet floor. It had like, I walk in learning it and Todd became one of my just most significant mentors in learning the power of vision. He didn't see it as a hotel gym. And we're talking like dumbbells that went up to 50 pounds. We're talking Smith machine, a chest fly, a leg press. Like, and it's all like the low quality, not the good stuff.
Yeah.
And it, not for one set, I walked in and immediately I'm like, I don't know about this. The second he started talking, I saw the vision. And I never saw it as a hotel gym ever again after the first day. And it was really interesting how that worked. But that's what allowed us the success that we had early on. And that's what allowed us to maintain this relationship that we have to this 20 years ago to the relationship we have today, is that notion of vision, that notion of this isn't just this. This is our intention. Our whys were aligned, and that's really rare. And so I started doing whatever I could, you know, one or two personal training sessions a week. But my job there was to lead the kids program, the kids camps and things like that.
So did you come in and kind of explain to Todd that that's where you wanted to be?
Yes.
Okay.
But then there's the reality of I also needed to pay rent. And so it's like, well, this is what I want to do. I want to lead the kids programs and have this robust and really make it a program.
Did he have kids per se, or did you have to really kind of go out and
nothing.
Yeah.
He just opened the doors.
Yeah.
So our first meeting, my interview that turned into a barbecue / business planning / just hang to 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. It was like, well, how are we going to get kids to come in? Like, we have zero. So how are we going to do this? So it was an early lesson in marketing. We started from zero. And so I had no clients. Neither one of us had any clients. And so just going from there, and over the years we had success pretty quickly. And then that grew. And, eventually the kids program took off. And at the time in the early 2000s, we were kind of the only show in town. Not a lot of people were doing the kids camp. Since then it's saturated. Everyone's figured out that the kids camp, particularly speed camps and sports camps. But early on we were working with all these schools. And we had a limited staff. So I have my coaches, but I'm working 60 client sessions a week, not just 60 hours, 60 client sessions, plus the planning, plus the marketing, plus all the different things. So it was a trial by fire. And for about 10 years, that was my life, was 60 to 80 hours a week doing these, you know, just, but again, even as I think back to that time, I don't think back to it as, oh man, I was just grinding, or, oh man, that's a lot of people, as we go through these times in our life that are almost trials, but these times when we're quote in the grind or trying to, improve or increase, and it's hard. It's huge intensity and volume of work. And I can attest to eventually you look back at that, and we look back at that with a smile, you know, because there's very few times in our life that we're that engaged with. It feels really good to be that engaged and that immersed in something. And so for about 10 years, that was my world.
Yeah. Well, you have to, if you think about training, there's very few things in life these days where you're one-on-one.
Yes.
You know, communicating, instructing, you know, there's all sorts of crazy stuff now, you know, people training with apps and phones and, you know, and if you're remote and can't get to a trainer, that's all good. But, that's crazy. And I think about what you mentioned, the early days of Todd's space and the floor, and, you know, it really makes you realize that true fitness, you don't need a lot of fancy stuff.
No.
You know, what you need is the vision, like you said, yes, that Todd had and that you guys developed. And so when you started working with kids, and I'm guessing this just really stuck with you from your days as the soccer.
100%. That really what it is, and that, because what that did working with the soccer thing, what it did is it showed me that was powerful to me, because I really thought that life was just a suck it up thing. You're going to enjoy your time with your family. You're going to enjoy your time away from work, but work was all about suck it up. Every couple of weeks, you get a paycheck. That paycheck should be enough to put a smile on your face for an inordinate amount of time. But realizing, and just, there's a youthful energy. A lot of people describe me as having a youthful energy. I'm terrified of, you know, I have a picture of an adult. I'm an adult and I enjoy being an adult, but I have a picture of what I don't want to be as an adult in my head. And I'm terrified of that picture. And so I guess I am youthful minded and spirited and things like that. So I match the kids' energy pretty well. And I understand, And I found over the years, what I really found was that that's what makes me unique. And that's what's something that, and even Todd, you know, I'm working for Todd and Todd's saying, you know, this is what you need to do.
Yeah.
You know, this is something. And to this day, you know, our relationship is very much like, you know, he understands, I don't, you know, I go and I do some things with Todd, but I am not necessarily an employee. And, but we're both happy with how things turned out and, you know, I followed what made me unique and it's been great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. You know, I definitely know you from, you know, conferences and workshops and seminars, and you definitely have established yourself in that niche, you know, of childhood training / development. You know, one of the reasons why I was so excited to talk to you is, you know, I've coached a lot of youth sports, including my two boys. I've done a lot of volunteer work. You know, I started to notice, oh gosh, maybe about 5 to 10 years ago, that a lot of stuff that maybe you and I knew how to do as kids, there's just no clue. And what I mean by that is how to kick a ball, throw a baseball, play frisbee. You know, I remember my son had a birthday party at a park and I like split up into teams to play kickball. I just assumed, especially I assumed the boys had a basic understanding of baseball.
Yeah,
these kids were kicking the ball and like running to third base. I'm like, whoa. You know, and not to mention just watching them, the coordination of them trying to kick the ball was just mind blowing. So, I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but what the heck happened to our kids?
So obviously that's the question. And I've had this discussion a million times and my answer to that's changed over the years. There's some things that are our fault to a certain degree, that, you know, the societal fault as parents, things that we could curb and change. There's some things that are just a sign of the times. And I think they're puzzles we need to figure out. You know, some of the things that aren't necessarily quote our fault. And it's just the reality where we're at is just the urbanization of almost everywhere and everything. I mean, everywhere I grew up in Oregon, we had a half acre, but outside that half acre was acres and acres of just
woods and trails,
run around and do something. And that was very common. They hadn't, if you lived in the city, you chose to live in the city and that was your decision there. You didn't get to necessarily do those things, but even in the city, kids are running around and doing stuff.
Right.
But you know, everything has been urbanized. Everything is in quarter or less than a quarter, eighth of an acre plots. Now you're in these developments. So, and within the developments, they're mostly streets. And streets, you got cars. And if you're near a city or some of these places, I mean, I honestly, like, I am the biggest promoter of physical activity with kids. I don't let my 5 or 6 year old just run. I live right next to canyons here. She does. There are. I don't let her run around there by herself.
Right.
There's weirdos, and we live in a great community. And there's those societal pressures that have stopped kids, at least parents, from feeling comfortable just sending their kids out to just do stuff. And when kids did that, you know, you talk about kickball, there'd be one kid that might have done kickball at his or her school. And so they'd be like, let's play this cool game I found. And they'd show the kids and they'd figure it out and they'd do their little game. And that's how I learned how to do almost everything. And that's just not happening as much. So those things are really hard to, you know, as a society, maybe we do need to look at some of those things. But then it falls onto the other place where you look at particularly the club sport industry. And the club sport industry is extremely profitable. And I think there are some good things to be gained from the club, the private club sport industry. Absolutely. But I think what's happened is that it's become so profitable that they just got to churn numbers. And I do not believe that the best interest of the kids is necessarily in mind. They're selling parents in this notion that all the kids are going to get college scholarships. They're trying to put the smoke and mirrors so the parents don't actually look at the statistics. But this idea you're going to get a college scholarship, they're going to be pro athletes. And if you don't play for our club, this is going to happen. If we don't get your $5,000 to $10,000 a year, this is what's going to happen. And so what it's done, it's created this tremendous specialization. And I think you know, kids are playing travel league baseball at 8 years old and they're playing nothing but baseball or nothing but soccer or nothing but volleyball or softball. And it's created the specialization. So if you're a baseball player, why would you learn how to kick a ball? That's just wasting time that you could be playing baseball. And where our fault, these organizations have made these promises, but parents, for whatever reason, have bought into this notion, and I truly believe there's a social currency to it. And the biggest example, I always use this example, but I've seen, you know, here in Southern California, we're surrounded by $100,000+ cars everywhere, you know, whether it's the newest, latest model, whatever. There's certain soccer clubs that are the prestigious soccer clubs. I have seen those particular soccer clubs bumper stickers on $100,000+ cars. So we're driving a status symbol. We're driving social currency. We're driving it around. We already decided we're going to spend this, we're going to invest this for social currency. And on top of that, okay, this is also social currency, because you would not put a sticker on a $100,000 car unless it's also some social currency. So I really think that, and that's a dangerous area for that to exist. Because the once it turns into that, then the best interests of the kids aren't mine. So I think there's certain things that are a sign of the times, and I think that we need to be aware of those things. And this is on top of physical education is not in schools anymore because of academic pressures. And we could have a whole nother conversation on that. Doesn't make any sense because there's a ton of literature and research that reinforces the notion of physical activity in the school actually improves academic performance. But that the limitations on funding there, the over-specialization in sports, and then we move into the virtual world of now. Back in the day, man, if I was bored, if I didn't have anything to do, go outside.
Yeah.
My mom would shut the door, figure it out. And now it's the parents are scared of their kids being bored. So they always have a device or something that they don't have to go out and figure out games or play hide and seek or play frisbee, or they can just be like, I'm bored. Oh yeah. I can watch a million programs on TV. I can go play my Xbox. I can look at my phone. I can play on the iPad. There's just too many things. And those are very quick, easy gratification. And that's our fault. And that's our fault individually. That's not the video game industry's fault.
Right.
In America, we have supply and demand. It's capitalism.
Right.
Supply and demand. If we stop the demand, then they stop the supply. It's not the other way around. Communism's when you stop the supply.
Yeah.
So I think that we need to recognize that the system we're in, we have a lot of power. A lot of food companies actually are completely they're losing billions of dollars because tastes are changing essentially for the better. You know, tastes are changing for healthier options. So some of these old school food companies, they have to start presenting some better options because the consumers have said, we're not going to eat that crap anymore.
Yeah.
$1 billion.
Yeah.
They're losing. So we do have power to make some of these changes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's unbelievable that I think Southern California is probably the mecca of club sports. And, you know, some of the things I see, you know, you mentioned the prestige. One of the bummers about that level of sports is I've always loved sports because I love seeing the kids come together to figure things out. And, you know, my son played youth football, and like, if your line is not together, you know, nothing's going to happen. The bummer with some of these club sports teams, especially the really elite levels, is these kids are coming from all over geographically to play on the best team. They don't even know each other.
No.
Or talk to each other.
It's a product.
You know? And like that just defeats the whole purpose. And, you know, I remember, not to knock, you know, private schools, but I remember talking to a football coach saying, you know, they were going to these passing league tournaments. And all the public school kids, they all knew each other. They all hung out together. The private school kids, because they had come from all different places, they were all on their phones. They weren't talking to each other. They weren't looking at each other. And it was like, we're missing the point here.
Well, if you stop and think, okay, what's the why? What's to be gained? And that's what's really fascinating when you look at some of these different things is, okay, what is to be gained individually from these organizations and things like that? Honestly, is it the best? I mean, because this is the really eye-opening. I've started working with some of the national governing bodies for some of these sports organizations. You would assume that some of these early sports specialization initiatives and some of these different things are coming from the top. You know, they're coming from USA basketball or USA soccer or USA, you know, that you'd think that some of these initiatives like, hey, we want you playing travel ball at 8 because that's going to create the best athletes. They're fighting that notion because they know it doesn't even create the best athletes. There's nothing to support the notion that creates the best athletes. So then it's like, okay, what actually is happening here? And it's an economy. It's a market. It's a, and I'm not, I don't necessarily, I think that one of the great things we have in this country is freedom to have a market and to find different ways to make income. But I, at the end of the day, I think it's a tragedy that it's become, kids have become a product. And of all the different ways to use sports as a tool to commoditize the notion of sport at a young age and to use that as the main thing. I mean, honestly, if you're doing single sport specialization with a child, it is exactly the same. And people laugh at this and say, oh, no. It might sound funny, but it's exactly the same as my daughter told me she wanted to be an astronaut. So I took her out of all art and English classes. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're going to be an astronaut. Okay. We're going to take astrophysics and that's where you're going to take math. You're going to take pro. That's all you're going to do because you said you want to be an astronaut. That's what's happening to kids in sports right now. And it's an absolute tragedy. And what I don't understand is we have a pretty economically savvy country. I don't understand how people aren't seeing what's happening. And again, there's nothing wrong with making money, but I think it's up to us as parents to evaluate, does this product, does this machine have the best interests of our kids in mind? Or is it just essentially an income machine using our kids as the fuel? And that's, to me, that's where it becomes disturbing.
Yeah. And you hit it right on the head. There's something also really strange with parents that have kids that, especially kids that are pretty talented,
mm-hmm.
that right off the bat, they discover their kid plays a sport. Oh, you know, little Joey's pretty good. We should get him a private coach. We should send him to this camp. We should do this. We should do that. And, you know, I live in a community where, you know, I'm really involved with the young track and cross country kids. And they're all like, we're going to Oregon. You know, I'm like, okay, you know, that's good. But, you know, broaden a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that is put in their head by the parents.
Yeah.
You know, they just get so overzealous. And you know, kind of moving into high school, you know, there's good and bad in high school too. And I think a lot of these coaches, in a perfect world, you should be able to play at least two sports.
Yeah.
Maybe even three if you think about
it.
Like when we were growing up,
I lettered in four my senior year.
Right. And you got to certain months. You get to November, football's over.
Yep.
You go into spring, which might be track. Then you might go into baseball and then in something else. But now these coaches, they've got you all year.
Oh, and it's political too. It's like, hey, there's some coaches like, hey, if you don't do this, and they're thinking about their job, they think, hey, if I put together a winning team, because at the end of the day, it's ends and means. I mean, a lot of parents will fall into the ends and they'll ignore the means and they'll look at, you know, okay, you won state, but at what cost? You know, you won this, but at what cost? Like, it's literally using the kids as fuel for this machine that's benefiting. The ultimate benefit is to entities within the adult world. And we need to realize that that's happening and put that into our decision-making process as parents. And again, I say, put into your decision-making process, because you might still be okay with that. And you still believe that that's the best for your child. And then if that's what you believe and you've made that evaluation and the truth lies within that, I think you go with what you say. But for me, I would need to feel very morally aligned with what I was involving my kids in.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the crazy thing is I can understand to a certain degree the pressures of maybe a varsity level coach.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're starting to see now is like the freshman coach.
Oh, yeah.
Just worried about his record.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could be he's got a football team of 40 plus kids, but he's playing about 16 or 17.
Yep.
You know what I mean? What development is taking place? And then they're all shocked that nobody moves up to JV.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what happened? Well, what do you think happened?
Yeah.
These kids want to play.
Yeah.
They're going to find a place where they can get on the field or the court or something.
Well,
high school's short.
Attrition rates are through the roof and they're growing. you're looking at 70% of kids are out of sports by the time they're 14. And a lot of it is because of that. There's just such a narrow funnel, and plus they're burnt out or they're injured or whatever it is. But those numbers are growing. So these a lot of these national youth sports organizations are concerned because participation is down. And when they look at really, okay, what's causing this? Unfortunately, they look and they see. And again, I think there's a lot to be the, I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with the club sports program. I played club sports. I think club sports offer all kinds of cool opportunities. And if you are talented, I think you should be able to go down a route that really develops you. But they've just, there's no regulation. There's no nothing. It's just the Wild West. And so then it's, you're depending on just a very strong ethical code, which is tough when you're dealing with you're dealing with kids.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's happening the way it should be is the question.
So I want to ask you about something that happened to you recently. I want to preface this by telling you, like, when I coach kids, there was a couple different seasons where I was not a real popular coach. Mm-hmm. And that's because I played all of my kids. And needless to say, our records were never very good. And I was one of those guys that, like, I would notice, like, who the first kids were that got to practice. And guess what? You're going to bat first. Yeah. That's how I made my lineup. And I would get all these angry emails, my son is batting this average and he should be fourth and blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, he didn't come to practice.
Yeah.
It was pretty simple, but which kind of led me to, something that happened to you recently. I think you were at a park, right? And you saw a dad, and you're a pretty mellow dude, but I think you were pretty close to,
you have limits. Yeah. And I think that's something that gets flipped up, when you're a parent. And I right away when I had my daughter, I told my wife this thing. I was like, I'm starting to, like, if I felt my daughter was in any form of harm, I had this switch. Yeah. There was this new thing in me. And I've had in the past, I haven't been afraid to defend myself, but just this like overt protectiveness. And I think it turns on as a parent. I was at a park and this dad, I mean, if you can call him that, was out hitting fungos, he's just hitting ground balls, yeah, just whatever to his kid. And there was like three kids out there. And one was obviously his kid, or two were his kid and one wasn't. And two of the kids are doing all right. And one of his kids was struggling. The rate to which he was berating this kid who was struggling, screaming. I was playing soccer with my 5-year-old. I just messed around on a field adjacent, but a ways away. And I'm hearing this. I'm like, is this real? Like, is that a joke that they have? Or no, this is real. This is an adult talking to a kid that way. And like, obviously the kid's doing worse and worse because he's just like, don't you care? You're making me sick right now. So kid missed the ball. He throws the bat against the fence. And then finally, so he's just berating. This kid, his chin is like through his chest at this point. I mean, this kid wants to leave the earth.
Yeah.
And then the dad quits. He throws the bat and he's like, I'm out of here. This is obviously, you don't care about this. If you want to ride home, you better hustle and, use profanity and all this. And it was everything in me, because when you see child abuse as a parent, it's not even my kid, but it's a societally, I think that's ingrained in us. That's not acceptable. And you have almost a primitive reaction to it. But I'm there with my 5-year-old and I'm just like, that's the only thing. If I was there by myself, I don't know. I mean, and I'm not saying that what the outcome would have been, but it was really hard to restrain in a situation like that when you're watching. But somehow that's not considered child abuse because it's in the context of sport. And that's a big question I have. If someone saw at the mall or at the grocery store and they're berating their kid like that, you'd have CPS there in a second. But because it's in the context of sport, it's like, well, that dad's just hardening his kids. That's wrong.
It's so funny when I coached youth football, we would oftentimes have problems with different coaches being a little abusive. And I remember one particular case, this guy kind of went after his own son who was on the team. And everybody was kind of like, oh, it's okay, it's his own kid. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
How does that make it okay? That makes it worse.
Yeah.
I think there's, I kind of talked about going back in time a little bit, and I, where I struggle is as a coach, I try not to really judge other coaches because most of them are giving their own time and they're volunteers. But it just seems like that attrition rate in sports has something to do with the people that are leading them. Like, we've lost the ability to make sure kids are not leaving with their chin down. I mean, to me, that was always one of my goals. I never wanted a kid to get in the car after practice and be upset. I wanted them to be pumped up, whether they were the third string kid or the starting quarterback. I wanted them to have the same experience, but something's changed.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, we're losing a few good men, so to speak, and women in the coaching ranks.
Yeah. You look at, I think to a certain point, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? So is it who holds the ultimate power? Is it that coaches are doing this because their organizations are expecting them to win? And so that pressure is increased. So now they're just, they're not trying to develop kids anymore. They're literally just trying to pick winners. Or is it that parents have created an expectation for what these coaches must do? So it's almost like, you know, at the end of the day, the coach is and every coach I talk to is just, the parents are the hardest thing about their job. So is it us as parents who are putting this expectation on coaches? So it is a chicken or the egg phenomenon, and I don't know the answer to that.
You know, what comes to mind is, if you think about, you know, when you and I grew up playing sports, our parents dropped us off at the field.
Yeah.
And they were gone.
Or we rode a bike.
Or we rode our bike, right? Or, you know, I can remember a time where, like, I carpooled with a bunch of kids. Now, the parents are right there on top of you.
Yep.
Like, in their chairs, on their phones.
Yeah.
You know, gossiping with the other parents. Mm-hmm. And it kind of starts to make sense now that you say that.
Yeah.
You know, that there is this added pressure. I remember coaching football. Like, we always want to talk to the kids after the game. Like, I would find a spot where we could get away from the parents. Like, we're going to go here around the corner behind the gym, meet by the water fountain.
Yeah.
Cause they would follow us. Yeah. You know, I'm like, hey, we need a minute.
Well, think about this too, though. And to give, as a parent, again, it has to be self-regulated, because as a parent, we care so much about our kids. And we say, if I go to my daughter's soccer practice and I stay there the whole time, I see that as like, well, I'm watching her. Like, she sees I'm there to support her. As parents, we are supportive. Like, it is good to show support. It is good to be present. And a lot of parents that get overconsumed, they do it starting from a good place.
True.
And it's emotional. It's visceral. If I see my kid had a bad experience in sports practice, so they lost the fifth game in a row and they're coming home and it sucks. They hate basketball, football, softball, tennis, whatever it is. I have a visceral reaction to that. But again, as parents, part of what makes us adults is that one extra step between stimulus and response. You know, that prefrontal cortex, that one extra step. So instead of just being like, I see that, I'm gonna have an emotional reaction to that. A higher level of thinking, a higher level human, and a higher level parent is someone who has the capacity to evaluate the situation and who has the capacity to think long-term and has the capacity to understand how having some discussions and being objective in situations, it is not the easy route. Putting that wedge between stimulus and response is a pretty unique neural process.
Yeah.
But it's something that I think that as adults in every aspect of life currently, we need to exercise a little bit more rigor when it comes to that.
Yeah. And we also have to be careful how we talk to our kids.
100%.
You know, I am like guilty as anyone in that, you know, because of my job in my organization, we spend a lot of time debriefing programs and meetings. And so that's just my natural instinct. So that's my instinct with the boys too. Like, after a game, I want to debrief and I'm like, no, you know, and I, you know, whether good or bad, have also had, you know, situations where my kids are pretty, pretty good at little athletes. And I remember there was one season where my son was running, my older son was running, my younger son was playing football. So my wife and I would often go in two different directions. Mm-hmm. And my older son was like winning all his cross country races. And this one particular day, my wife came and sat in the stands because he had run and Brady was at football. So I was coaching Brady, and And I kind of turned around and I looked at her to say, you know, how did Blake do? And she held up three fingers, like third place. And I kind of started to mouth, what the, like, yeah. You know, and then I kind of had to slap myself like, okay, you know.
But here's the thing is, yeah. It's to have that reaction, that's a normal thing. But like you said, you slapped yourself. You would put that wedge between just stupid human.
Yeah.
You know, just we're stupid humans. We're, yeah. We got this monkey brain that just wants to respond and react to everything. But we put that wedge in there and it's like, that wedge is what's important.
Yeah. So the other, you know, the other thing that I think is worth discussing is, so you, let's just say you do get kids into sports and they're on a good team. They've got a good coach. One of the problems I'm really seeing is food.
Yeah.
Especially with, you know, kind of the running community, mm-hmm. especially the females, they're coming in with nothing.
Yeah.
You know, or worse, it's the Cheetos and the soda and, you know, just kind of getting personal for a minute, you know, how have you brought your daughter up and what are some of the ways you've tried to, when you're working with your kids, either at Fitness Quest 10 or the mm-hmm. company we're going to talk about in a minute, to get them to think about food?
Yeah. So within our family, if to me, as a parent, you choose your battles. And to me, not that it's a battle, but nutrition is something I'm willing to give an inordinate amount of time and energy to, because I've seen the outcome if you don't. And so for us, but it's, we don't use the word healthy or unhealthy. We don't use the word, you know, high calorie. We don't, it's more just like, what foods help you grow? Whoa, that you're eating those, you know how much those make you grow? Like, and it's because that's relevant to my 6-year-old. That's the way we discuss food in a relevant way. And she'll get to an age where that's not as relevant. So then we're going to make it relevant to whatever is relevant to her.
Right.
You know, food is not, I think with the language that's used at home with parents, that the idea that, well, healthy food is yucky, but it makes mommy or daddy skinny, but you're skinny. So you can still at this day and age, parents will tell me, well, I'm not worried about what they eat. They stay skinny. As if your only goal behind health is to somehow be in a magazine cover or look hot to somebody someday.
Right.
It's mind blowing. That's honestly, I try to understand where people are coming from. At this point in this day and age, I don't understand the, well, they can eat anything. They'll just stay skinny. They need the, well, it's not that. It's the idea of, do they understand that food has a utility? And food has a utility to make you grow and whatever. And food also has a utility to just, it just tastes good and it's yummy. And that's really where it's like, well, that cookie, cookies don't help you grow, but it's good. So you're going to eat cookies. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's what's tied. So it's slowly getting kids to understand that, well, anything you do, if you tie it to something relevant, it has a utility. Food is an opportunity. And that's where you breed this notion that food is an opportunity. Food's not an obstacle. I think through society, we've somehow, this is really weird. How did food become an obstacle? Food's the only reason we're walking around right now. Food has somehow become an obstacle in our normal day-to-day conversation. Food's an opportunity. Food's an opportunity to feel great. Food's an opportunity to be healthy. Food's an opportunity to perform well. Food's an opportunity to have energy. And we've turned it into this, the food is this thing we need to avoid somehow. And so many people say, oh, I'd eat better, but I just love food. If you love food, that's an opportunity.
Yeah.
And so you see all these things and you see it, and there are some complexities that go into this, you know, socioeconomic status. If you're in the inner city, there's food deserts where you don't have access to reasonable food. But when you and I, what we're seeing in areas where there's plenty of access, Southern California, most major cities now, there's access to great choices for food. But I think as opposed to, I grew up, my dad worked, my mom stayed home. That doesn't happen as much anymore. You have two working parents trying to navigate all this. So convenience, the role of convenience has stepped up quite a bit. So in order for parents to pay attention to nutrition, it does take a commitment, a larger commitment of time and energy. But I think as parents, we need to evaluate, what if we don't? You know, what's the end result? And it's not fat and skinny. That's not the end result. It's, are we contributing to a lot of the problems that we see coming up. So I think when you talk to kids, it's food is not an evil thing. It's not an obstacle. Food's an opportunity, but just starting to guide those relationships between how food is an opportunity. What do you want? How you eat, how you think, how you move, how you act, how can all those help you get there?
Yeah. And you know, one thing that was really kind of a shock to me, because my family's we're pretty tight unit, mm-hmm. and we always make sure to eat together.
Yes.
And we never did anything different for them. You know what
yes.
I mean?
Yes.
They got what we got. And I'm always shocked by the parents that cook their food.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
And then their kids' food. And I'm like, why would you do anything different? And you know, we're lucky in a sense that my kids at an early age wanted to be adults. Like they yeah. wanted to be big kids.
Yep.
And so the thought of a kid's menu to them was insulting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In the few times where they did get something, they were eating my food and I would end up eating their food.
Yep.
So I'm kind of blown away by that. And I, you know, I actually talked to a parent once and they said, well, it's cost. And then that kind of like set me off on another tangent. I'm like, really? I mean, you only get one kid.
Yeah.
You know,
the cost thing. I think that if we're talking about organic, organic, non-GMO, we go down the Whole Foods route. Yeah. There's some validity to that. You know, you buy these labeled quote healthy things and the cost is through the roof, but to understand that kids need to eat vegetables, well, they don't like vegetables. Well, they need to try them. And like you said, that's one thing that does. I think as parents, we have this innate need to feed our kids. And so if I give my daughter something, she doesn't eat it. My brain says, she has to eat. Potato chips. She'll eat potato chips. So here's hot dogs and potato chips. And that's your every meal. But again, it's that extra wedge between stimulus and response that it's like, well, kids aren't going to starve themselves to death. They're not. And so this is what you got to eat. And if you don't want to eat that, because think about what that does. It's a separate shopping list. It's a separate amount of time cooking. That won't happen here. And again, as parents, it's like you don't want to be the parents judging other parents because everyone is in a different situation.
Yeah.
But I would challenge parents to stop and think about that what is the end result if your young kid survives in hot dogs, chicken nuggets, and something else, because by the age of six, they're starting to form essentially taste buds, the relationship between taste and emotional centers of their brain. So if they think that the world tastes like sugar, salt, and oil, well, it's an uphill battle from there on out to try to get them to try to eat something that's not sugar, salt, oil, or just whatever's been fabricated in the lab. And again, it's an evaluation as a parent. It's not me saying, hey, what are you doing, stupid? It's an evaluation of parents. Stop, take a deep breath, put a wedge between the stimulus and response and say, what am I really trying to do here? And do I want to teach them that they just eat whatever's good at that time? And that's a tough thing. It really is, because we don't want to see our kids not eat. But sometimes it isn't. And you talk to the experts and all of them say, yeah, just they'll eat eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all of our pediatricians say, you know, I've never come across a kid that starved to death.
Yes.
You know, not here where we live. And, you know, the unfortunate thing that parents are not seeing is, and I think about some family members and some kids that I know that don't eat very well, or they're still eating what I call kids menu type
yeah.
foods. They're starting to suffer from different skin
yes.
allergies. I know a kid that broke his hip at 12. That should never happen.
No.
You know, but they're not connecting the dots
yeah.
that this is taking them towards a path.
Or behavioral issues or sleep interference
right.
or emotional outbursts. Or when they don't have nutrition, if their cells don't get the things, they're literally saying, hey, I need this from you. I can't make this internally. If they're not getting that, why would they be operating at any level that would be sufficient cognitively, physically, emotionally?
Yeah. So, yeah, we have a lot of work to do.
We do.
So, well, I want to get back to your journey. So,
yeah.
you know, from working with Todd at Fitness Quest, you have now moved on into some new adventures, including Spider Fit Kids.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about that? First of all, tell me, how'd you come up with that name?
So it was funny. As we started the company, because myself and a couple of the other people that started it with me, you know, we had all had kids roughly at the same time. And was really the switch that flipped it, because I'd been working the kids space. I had been writing and doing things in the kids space because not that many people were. And people would find themselves going to me for those different things. And I saw this, but I just was tentative, like anybody who's starting a new venture. I was tentative, like, well, I don't know if that's really what I want to do. I'm just kind of scared to leap. And so we finally did, and we're trying to think of a name, and we realized what was making us different is we had to come up with this approach to kids' fitness that wasn't just boot camping our kids, that wasn't just sports performance, that was more of a, hey, let's teach kids how to play again. And we've coined the term powerful play. And because there's one side that's all sports performance, but then there is the absolute other side of the coin. Well, just get the kids doing something. True. Just get the kids moving, but there's opportunities. Like kids can just do something, or we can just sort of give them some inspiration for play, that different types of play can stimulate different parts of the brain. We can help with development. And so we said, well, really, what are we doing? And we worked a lot with occupational therapists. And what we found, what made us really different, is that we had really explored and gotten into like the perceptual motor skills and the sensory motor system. And not a lot of people were looking at that as a fitness type of thing for kids or as a way to get kids more active. It was just sort of, well, if kids have emotional issues or something, they go to occupational therapists, they do these special exercises. But we realized that most kids have movement pathology at this point because they don't move. And so we're trying to figure out, well, what's it, you know, we focus on the sensory system and we do all this and we're throwing out names, and somebody said, well, like the spidey senses. And we had a chart, you know, we're putting all these in, and then someone said like spider fit. And then it just kind of stopped. It's like, oh yeah, I can see that. Because part of it too is we wanted it to be something that kids would respond to, because we're not out doing kids programs. We're educating the educators. But we wanted something, if someone said, hey, we're gonna do a Spider Fit program, like, and kids get excited about it, and our logo is kind of cool. And so it kind of just fit this overall youthful, we didn't want to be the institute of something, because we wanted to be very much, very clear that, hey, this is about kids. This is not about this is not a ego project to prove to everyone how smart I am. This is something that we want to truly, yeah, we're gonna have research. And yes, this is all gonna be hashed out into framework. It's not just gonna be stuff. But at the end of the day, it's about the kids getting a smile on their face and getting excited to be active and athletic for the rest of their life.
You know, it's funny, as you described your process of coming through the name, like as soon as you said it, I'm like, oh,
yeah,
that really does hit, you know?
Yeah.
No, that's great. And I, you know, one of the things you've always been good at is, I would kind of say, gamifying. You know, I think about the words you use and, you know, different things. And ironically, now we have adults like craving that. They're like, hey, Andy, can you come and set up some games for us?
Yeah.
You know, so we've kind of reverted back to that. So it's really good to see that, you know, you starting with kids at an early age.
Yeah.
Because those are going to be the kids that grow up and train the next generation. You know what I mean?
Well, they are. And for kids to see that sports are great, but you know, I was just talking to somebody yesterday who was thinking about, he was looking at starting like a wiffle ball league. And he was going to start these leagues that were not the competitive, so that kids that could play their competitive sport, but during like an off season, they could just do some, which by the way, that's what they're doing now. They got the kickball leagues for like the 20 somethings are really into like these, you know, kickball or all these different things, because they aren't the pressure. But they're saying, well, how about the young kids who are just pressured all year? Maybe this is a way to teach them things that they can play into their 20s, but it comes down to, and when we, honestly, this came from a place of, you know, I enjoy doing it because I found it with my adult clients and my kids. I got more out of them when I could gamify. And it doesn't mean that training is all a circus.
Right.
It's a dose. It's an opportunity to say, okay, well, we're going to teach these fundamentals, but then we get to play this game. But yeah, it's parents and kids. And I think it's exciting because if they can tie back into that fun, it's not just utility. It's, I exercise because I have to lose weight, my doctor said. It's like, I move because it's fun and I feel better afterwards. That's when we have a win in our healthcare system. Because if we exercise merely out of obligation, forget it, ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. Like when you talk to the person that's like, oh, I gotta go to the gym later. Yeah. Like, that sounds horrible the way you just terrible. Said it.
And by the way, their kid hears them say that.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like something I want to do when I'm an adult.
Yeah.
That type of punishment.
No. You know, I love the wiffle ball thing. It's both exciting and sad at the same time. It's exciting that people are discovering those things. It's sad because we did it as kids.
Absolutely.
Like, we didn't need a league. Hey, let's go meet on the corner.
Yeah.
You know, you put the frisbee down for first base and the rock for second. And
a home run's that person's lawn. Right. And if it hits a car, it's a foul ball. But if it's a moving car, it's a home run.
It's your turn to jump the fence and get the ball that's in the yard with the dog. So, that's exciting. It's It does make me sad to a degree that our kids are not experiencing that the way we did.
Organically,
you know, and as you and I talked about earlier, a lot of it is, you know, you would typically have one or two kids that know something to teach everybody. I don't even think we have that anymore, you know, so there's no leader to get them going.
Because that came from PE or that came from something their family did, and they just don't. They don't do that. And the irony of it is with the powerful play and what we call our program and all that, there's this large part of me. I wish, it sounds crazy. I wish my company didn't have to exist. Honestly.
True.
It's a response. This is a response to a need and essentially a solution to a problem that I think all of us wish didn't exist. And there's people that say, well, just get the kid. And I had heard, and part of forming the company was, how long can we hear? Well, just get them out playing again. We just need to get them out playing again. Okay. How is that rhetoric gone for the last 15 years of saying, we just need to get them out playing again? Well, okay. Here's how we can do that. Here's some strategies. And by the way, here's the outcomes if we have them do this. Here's the cognitive. Here's the physical. Here's the emotional outcomes through these strategic different things. The kids don't need to know the science and the strategy and all that. They're just having the time of their lives without a coach screaming down on them the whole time. We can, as adults, know that, wow, this is an important thing. And hopefully we're instilling in these kids that go on generations in the future. And they say, oh, I remember this game. And you know, let's play this. They're kids.
Yeah. You know what my dream has been lately? And you're probably going to laugh. But my dream has been that I get to coach a high school team, football, track, baseball. But I get the kids that don't care about winning or didn't make the team or didn't make varsity or JV. And we just get to play other teams and not worry about the record. When we're done, maybe we hang out with the other team and have, you know, barbecue or something, and that the kids learn the sport as opposed to sitting on the bench because they can't crack the two deep, you know, to get onto the field. And, you know, it's like, I think about that and I'm like, I would be run out of town. You know what I mean? It's like, what? Yeah. You're 0-10?
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, but look at 35 kids got to play that otherwise wouldn't get to play.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's value in winning and losing. And I think there's value in the pursuit of winning and the avoidance of losing. There's value in all those. But I think that's become overvalued, because one of the criticisms to an approach of letting all kids play is like, well, that's not the real world. In the real world, you got to try. And there's some of that I agree with. I think that sports are a valuable tool to teach success and failure. But when that's the only thing that's garnered from it, like at the end of the day, it's like, it's not what did you learn? How could you get better? All these different things. Just, it says W or it says L. If it says L, all we do is run around and celebrate. We're the greatest in the world. And if it says L, then we, you know, if it says W, we're the best. If it says L, we're the worst.
Yeah.
That's what they take about it. If it's L, it must have been the referees. It must have been my teammates. It must be the coach sucks. It must be the field conditions. It must be the whatever. And it's gone to this whole thing. So I think that in the ideal world, you look at this mix of, I mean, yeah, we're going to work in the skills. We're going to do all this. In other countries and their developmental models, it's not who scores the most goals, who hits the most home run, it's who has the skill set, who has that X factor that can take it to the next level. And, you know, I was reading a book, and this was years ago, but they're talking about the developmental model in Holland for soccer, and Holland created a world superpower. And this American coach went over, is like, well, this kid is scoring all the goals. And he's like, hey, you know, who's this kid? This is the future, huh? The coach said, he ain't gonna make a team. The Dutch guy said, he ain't gonna make a team. He's like, what? He scored like 10 times as I've been sitting here. The kid's like 8 or 9. He's like, okay, watch. When he gets the ball, his eyes go down. He has no sense of where the field is. All he knows is to kick the ball as hard as he can. He's got an early growth spurt, so he plays like a caveman. This is the kid we're watching. And it's this kid who's kind of small, but the kid is, he's doing what you should be doing in certain situations. It's like, I can't teach that. Notice how he's moving with the ball. Notice how he's moving towards the ball. Notice how he waited on his run here. And he's 8 or 9 years old, and he understands that he didn't score the entire time he was there. He didn't do anything flashy, but he's like, that's the kid we're watching. And the American coach was like, oh my God, like that. But I think that exemplifies our system here. And I think to your point of having a team where they learn the game and just not focusing necessarily, that's the recommendation actually for development all the way up till they're like 12 years old. Is through that, it's just working skill. Yeah, let have them, you know, play each other and just for fun. But at the end of the day, if they won, but they did it by playing like a bunch of monkeys, you know, just going out there like a bunch of apes and just, well, that's not a solid win. Like this is the game of baseball. This is the game of soccer. This is the game of tennis. Did you play that game? And that's because then when they go in fundamentally sound and they get their growth spurt and they get with a good coach, a good team, good situation, their skill goes off the charts. Their success goes off the charts. So I think that, you know, to your point, I think that's a huge opportunity to just say, okay, no, we're going to learn the sport. We're going to learn how to do it. And everything about the sport, like you said, the socialization of it, that's part of it, the camaraderie.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was just talking to a dad of a freshman parent in a high school the other day, and he was saying that when the team scores, like he was surprised that there wasn't a lot of like hooting and hollering and celebration. And I kind of prodded him a little more, and I'm like, well, kind of makes sense. He's got this giant team. Mm-hmm. Only a small fraction of the kids are actually getting onto the field.
Yeah.
So do you think these kids that are watching are really going to be all that excited?
Yeah.
No, you know, ownership. Because they're not part of it. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like my dream, like, give me those kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's go play somebody. And yeah, we'll try to win. But if we don't, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure every kid gets X amount of plays.
Yep.
Because especially in today's world where you're making them come out all summer.
Oh.
You're charging them a fortune.
Yeah.
You're punishing them if they don't join the club team. If they're going to give you all that, you got to give them something in return.
100%.
You know, so anyway, that's my dream. We got off on a tangent.
That's a good dream though.
But so, hey, thanks so much for your time. We're a little over an hour here. I do want to kind of wrap up with a couple things. One of the questions I always get that you could help me with is, at what age can my kid start weight training?
Mm-hmm.
And
common question.
Yeah, I struggle with that. So,
I think the important part there is define weight, because kids, as soon as they move against gravity, they're weight training. They're putting a load on their skeletal system. They're putting a load on their joints, tendons, ligaments, muscles, tissues, all that. The question becomes, well, you know, what age should that become the focus, where load becomes the focus? It's like, okay, how much load can you move? And the best answer to that question, if you look at research, I mean, really the only age, honestly, and this is sounds crazy, but the only age requirement there is, at what age do they have the attention span, the interest, and the capacity to take coaching? Because as soon as, let's say I'm teaching kids how to do push-ups or squats, or I'm teaching them these basic fundamental movement patterns, and all of a sudden they're just like, they do it like it's a joke. You know, they bang out 30 push-ups and 30 squats. It's just like, this is easy. Well, if I want to see their neuromuscular system progress, in other words, I want to see them do better, then I would need, that's just a universal. If you want to see an improvement, increase load. And I don't care if you're trying to do better in your career. I don't say if you're trying to do, no matter what it is in life, you need to increase the stimulus. And so realize carrying a backpack is weight.
Yeah.
And people freak out because, well, they're not afraid of a kid carrying a 20-pound backpack, but as soon as that backpack becomes a dumbbell, it's somehow rupturing the growth plates. There's no research to substantiate any of these fractured growth plates, decreased growing,
right.
All of these other things. Actually, the research is in line with better coordination, improved confidence and competence on in anything they do, improved body composition, decrease injury. I mean, these are all things that are associated with resistance training. But again, realize that body weight against gravity is resistance. So if a child can't do something body weight against gravity, it makes no sense to add extra load. So if I'm doing a specific thing, if I'm doing squats per se, you know, kids are doing squats and they can't do a squat, I would not add any load. So if they can all of a sudden do squats, well, I'm going to start hold a medicine ball. Okay, they're going to fatigue quicker. The neuromuscular system says, oh crap, we better get our act together at a higher level in order to accommodate this. The research shows that kids don't respond to resistance training like we do. So they don't get an influx of hormone that makes their muscles grow. That doesn't happen. They don't have the hormone. Also, their anaerobic system, because their anaerobic system's that without oxygen, kind of that power system, it's not good. And hormonally, it just hasn't developed. Kids are oxidative. So really, when kids improve their strength from resistance training, that improvement is from increased motor coordination. In other words, they just learn how to do it better.
Right.
So I think that the end all be all answer to what age is okay for kids to weight train, I think we change that word to resistance train. And then it becomes, well, then at what age are they able to take cues from a coach? Because as soon as they're doing a body weight squat against gravity, they're moving against 10 meters per second squared, plus their body weight.
Right.
And all that load is going. So that's resistance training. Gravity is your, so I think that's the only concern I have. And even with my daughter, when she wants to mess around in the garage, kids do get injured dropping things on their feet. They do get injured running into things. They do get injured tripping over things. There is research documented, plenty of evidence of that. So, you know, and just monkeying around in the weight room. So those are the things I would look for. So if you so if you do have a child, first, as they're getting into learning some of the movements associated with weight training or resistance training, first focus on technique is first. First, are they doing it correctly? Can they do it correctly in their sleep? Has it become easy for them? At that point, add some form of resistance. From a safety standpoint, I'm a huge fan of Hyperwear sandbells. Have you seen the mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan. I'm not paid by them. I'm just a huge fan because I can have a room full of 20 kids and throw those things. No one's going to get hurt. You can't get hurt. Yeah. They could throw them in the air and hit them in the head. It's not going to hurt them.
Yeah.
Those are great opportunities to do things like that. But once you get into dumbbells and kettlebells, unless I'm standing there one-on-one with a child, I don't care what age it is, that there's, it doesn't make any sense. It's dangerous. And because right now the answer, most people say, we'll only get into high school. That's when it's safe. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, because I coached in high school strength and conditioning. Freshmen show up, they can't do a body weight squat. Why would I put a 45 pound bar on top of their spine if they can't do a body weight squat? But why wouldn't I, with a seventh grader who's been doing this for a long time, that can do a perfect squat, they've been working up, they've been holding medicine balls and backpacks or sand bells, and the last sand bell they held onto was 35 pounds and they can rip out 20 squats, no problem. Why wouldn't I just increase the challenge? Why wouldn't I do that? And so there's two different thought processes there that it's not making sense. Ninth grade is not. The one thing that will happen in ninth grade is that hormone system does kick on. So that is an opportune time at the onset of puberty through the end of puberty, because you have so much growth hormone and testosterone going around the system, you're going to see a huge increase in the trajectory of improvement, muscle cross-sectional size. Yeah, that's a really opportune time to do it. But before then, you're going to see all kinds of cool benefits too, if you do it smart. The goal has to be, though, correct execution, because that's how they're going to get stronger, is correct execution. They're not going to get stronger from the extra load, because their anaerobic system doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really tough, especially with the male crowd.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of a machismo thing going 100%. On in a high school gym. And, you know, it's not uncommon for me to be out at the field, you know, through track or lacrosse or whatever the sport is. And I look over at some of the kids in the weight room and they're holding their low back.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, man, you're going to be dealing with that your whole life. It's a little too early now, but then you kind of peek in, you're like, oh shoot, you know, these insane loads. And what I've discovered with the high school athletes, a lot of them can't even touch their toes.
Well, and it's because of the growth trajectory. That's one thing that we have to be careful with, particularly really starting like for boys. For girls, it starts a little bit earlier, but for boys around seventh grade, through about 10th grade, they go through this major, most boys, and granted this can be shifted either side, but they go through this huge growth trajectory. So think about what happens there. So you got the muscle, which the muscle is not, the muscle might grow in cross-sectional area, but it's not necessarily, it's lengthwise, it's responding to the bone. So you have a bone that all of a sudden just starts growing. Well, those tendon attachments and its origins and attachments, all of a sudden that tendon is put under all this pressure. And finally, the tendon says, okay, I'm gonna lengthen, I'm gonna do what I need to do. But the stimulus first goes to the bone. So the bone gets longer, the muscles, the tendons, everything's like, it's all of a sudden. So you're gonna see that particularly in hamstrings. And so then it's like, okay, well, if you have kids squat, you know, kids deadlift, some of these that rely on hamstring strength, by no means does that mean you can't do it, but at least make sure they can do it correctly without load first. Right. But here's the thing with that. So the machismo thing, so I've worked with kids, I use that to my favor. So I said, okay, well, for one, you can't bench press, because that's what they all want to fight for, until you can squat your body weight. Here's how you can squat your body weight on the bar. Mm-hmm. And these kids who get, so they're coming in before and after school to practice squat, wall squats, and all these different ways to learn how to squat. And then they're put on, so these kids all of a sudden, just because I did that, they're starting to go through this progression on their own, because they knew the gateway to them being able to do what they wanted to do was they had to learn how to do this thing correctly and do it at a high level. So the machismo became who could do it the best, who could do the best squat, who could do the best deadlift.
Yeah, I like
that. Yeah. It changed the game. So I use that to my advantage.
Oh, that's great. No, and I like the kind of metaphor for life, increase your load. Like,
yeah.
You want to get better at something, increase your load. Those are great tips. I mean, there's just a lot of unfortunately, a lot of unsupervised stuff going on, but you know, it's the good and the bad. The good is they're in there, they're doing the thing. Yes. The bad is that, you know, like I said, I see the guys holding their low back. I'm like, oh shoot.
Yeah. You know, it's just injuries that don't need to happen.
Just exactly. Yeah. And in fact, if you're doing it correctly, you should be pushing that injury off for quite some
preventing time.
But well, hey, this has been great. I've always appreciated your insight. I know you probably don't remember, but you've talked me off the cliff a couple of times when I get all hyped up about kids. And I think we talked about the Olympics once and the sponsors and the fast food and all that. But, where can people find you?
So our website, SpiderFit Kids, it's just spiderfitkids.com.
Okay.
Also on Facebook, you know, our website, we post a lot of stuff, but Facebook, we're very active. We're twice a day. We're posting research videos. It's not fluff pieces. I mean, and that's a big part of our company, is we don't necessarily want just the fluff, just the feel good. We want to be like, no, we're saying this because of this. And so we post a lot of that through our Facebook page, and that's just SpiderFit Kids. But just access to our resources, if you're interested in what we're doing, if you just go to SpiderFit Free, so just spiderfitfree.com, you can download a bunch of just free stuff. If you're a coach, we just give away a lot of ideas and things like that.
Oh, that's great. So yeah, definitely. If you're a coach or a parent or even a young athlete looking for some help, definitely check out SpiderFit Kids, reach out to Brett. You know, he's great in following up, and this has been awesome. I really appreciate
your
time.
Thank you, Andrew. This
was fun. Yeah. Everything except for the weather down here in San Diego.
I know.
It is like 1,000 degrees and
it's
humid.
It's humidity. We're not supposed to have humidity. I don't get it.
But awesome. Well, thanks so much. Let's definitely keep in touch.
For sure.
We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Andrew.